So you're comfortable there?
I am very comfortable here.
Okay. How has your arrival been? I know you're true.
Well, after arriving thing. Basically 5 hours late.
Did you just have to wait at the airport then?
I waited at O'Hare, and they flew me to Omaha instead of to Sioux City.
Oh, okay.
And so Jim was extremely kind and immediately said he could come out to get me.
Oh, that's good. That's really good. Well, Omaha's a nice place to fly into, I guess.
Things have to happen once in a while.
It allows us to tell stories.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Which is important.
I don't have too many of those, luckily. I don't generally miss my flights, but
well, that's very good with all your traveling and a life about the world. Yes. You don't want to have that reputation.
No, in your profession.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Do you have any questions for me before we start? I don't know if you have any concerns.
Will I be playing whole pieces? Or?
If you could. We have the whole hour to fill. So.
Okay.
And I think people would prefer your playing to my talking. So I'm hoping, if you're willing, I will take as much as you're willing to give. Okay, we have 15. That really reverberates, doesn't it? Welcome to a special broadcast from the Levitt Gallery on the campus of Morningside College. I'm Siouxland Public Media's Mark Munger. Jory Vinicour is my guest. Born in Chicago, but a true citizen of the world, Jory has performed as a soloist and with such orchestras as the Philharmonic of Radio France, the Moscow Chamber Orchestra, and the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. He has accompanied Anna-Sophie von Otter from Sweden to the Teatro alla Scala. His recordings have been included in many yearly best of lists, nominated for Grammys, and are prized by critics. And he is here with me in Sioux City.
Hi, Mark.
It's amazing. Hours from his recital, which will be in the same gallery, in the Levitt Gallery, tonight at 7:30. I'm truly honored to have you here, and I'm glad you made it. You overcome some obstacles to get here.
Some small travel difficulties, and thank you for your flexibility.
Oh, please. Yeah. This is a true pleasure for us. It worked out beautifully. There is another guest in the room that I didn't mention, but one that will be joining you at the recital. It's this instrument, the harpsichord
that we have before us.
And I was thinking, first I wondered, how did you begin playing the harpsichord? It's an unusual instrument to take up in modern times.
It would seem to be an unusual instrument, particularly in the United States, still, where we don't encounter it quite as often as we do in Europe. But when I was a little kid, I think I was first introduced to the sound of this instrument, probably on some of these PBS series, like Elizabeth R., if you remember this. It's much before your time, but you know, we had wonderful music being played by, I think it was actually being played by Christopher Hogwood on the virginals, and I found this instrument just enchanting, and the music enchanting. And as I became a little bit older, getting into high school, I became curious to know what the music of Bach, for instance, would sound like on the instrument for which he composed it. I began checking out various records at that time, listening to artists like Wanda Landowska, who was a great, great Polish performer, but who played on a kind of a hybrid harpsichord, which was almost like a great big piano with a complex plucking mechanism. And finally, getting away to college, discovering really what the instrument was, what it had been in the Baroque epoch. And I took up lessons on the harpsichord alongside my piano studies from the onset of university.
Okay, growing up and being attracted to this instrument, could you even find one that you could go?
No, and in Chicago, in my youth, I could not.
Even in Chicago? So it's difficult.
At that time, no. I wouldn't have known the people as a kid in high school who could have showed me that instrument. And when I think of it now, there are really a very, very good handful of us in Chicago who play the instrument. I teach certain students, but of kind of professional age. So I don't know if we've got some little kids hopping around Chicago taking harpsichord lessons. I rather hope so.
Yes.
But it perhaps it remains unusual, but a little bit less rare.
Mm-hmm. I think the story in the United States with the harpsichord is we do sort of think of it as an antiquated instrument.
That
the piano came along and took its place, and we're moving on. But is it different in Europe?
Yeah. Yes, to a large extent, it is different. I think the classical music world in Europe, being somewhat subsidized by the state, we have room for more kinds of music. Although, I mean, I should point out, even in this country, some of the bigger Baroque orchestras, in other words, groups playing on gut string violins, et cetera, some of these groups will sell out any hall in the country. You know, I toured with Philharmonia Baroque last year, who's a San Francisco-based group, and we sold out enormous halls. So the American concert-going public is informed and curious. Hmm. So that's kind of going backwards from your question.
It also goes backward to the idea, well, if there's a national interest, say in Europe, the state takes it up. But here, PBS and public broadcasting has often kept those, you know, these forms of music, these styles of music in the public eye.
Yes. I mean, it's very interesting. I think to my years in France, I lived in France for well over 20 years and taught in one of the big national conservatories. And there, where music education is also supported by the state and is basically free, you get the little kids and their parents who, you know, go around. If the kid's interested in piano, hopefully he or she will have the possibility of taking piano lessons. But during my 6 years of teaching, I had tons of little kids. I think they liked the instrument. They also, you know, found the amusing American guy, you know, probably a little more fun to be with than a French piano teacher who would whack them on the wrist, although I was probably even worse than they were once they got to know me. But, so during those 6 years of my life, I had many, many young harpsichord students, and that was kind of fascinating. How do you teach this instrument as a beginning instrument?
Mm-hmm. Yes, because I assume you began as a
Of course, I began as a pianist and went to, through my bachelor's degree in college as such.
So moving from the piano to the harpsichord, because the fingering is quite different, was that a big challenge?
It's so interesting. I mean, for our listening public who can't see, I'm looking at an instrument which in this case is nearly five octaves, F in this case only to E for reasons which are a little bit difficult to explain. It's a transposing instrument. So we have a nearly five octave instrument, two keyboards. So we hear again. And they look rather like piano keys, although in this case, the diatonic or C major keys are in a very dark ebony wood. The raised keys, the sharps, are in a kind of cowbone white. So certain pianists sit down and find this either very intriguing or confusing or so forth. However, what I would always like to say is that the similarities between the instrument are the danger, because they're not played much the same.
Right, because you could approach it just the same, thinking this is just another keyboard.
Could. And I think, again, even very fine pianists who sit down and want to play some Bach discover immediately that it doesn't quite respond the same way.
That must be incredibly frustrating to have worked so long to perform a piece and then move to another instrument.
It takes time. If the interest and passion mm-hmm. is there, it just takes some time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to speak for everybody. I do feel that a high level, very high level performance capability at both instruments would be unlikely. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say there is nobody, but it's kind of the case. And I don't know precisely why that is. I would get myself into trouble with various pedagogues, but I mean, I could say already that at the harpsichord, so much of what we do is predicated on the most delicate touch of the string. I mean, I again trying to bring your listening public right here to the keyboard with me, but the amount of weight required for me to pluck that string is just nothing. Mm-hmm. It's a whisper. So while I need to have the rest of my body well poised and supported, it requires no strength. There's no brute strength. Where the piano, no matter what your school is, whether it's Russian school or the more delicate ones, of course, the idea of having to throw a hammer, piano mechanism is that. You don't just touch the string, you must finally throw the hammer, requires an element of physical involvement that we won't ever have at the harpsichord, really, or a different type.
Right, and in this case, you're plucking a string. So even the way you describe it, it's much more delicate than throwing a hammer. We're plucking strings.
Here. Yes. Yeah, which is, you know, we're discussing a plucked string instrument. The mechanism of a normal harpsichord is far, far more straightforward than that of a piano, where I have a key. Hello, public. I'm touching a key right now, which is a lever of wood reaching under the instrument. That, in turn, pushes up a little plank of wood that we call the jack, fixed into the jack, is a little tongue of boxwood. Into that tongue is fixed a little plectrum. And as I touch the key, I feel a little bit of resistance under the finger. And that resistance is really the string about to be plucked by the plectrum. So very much like a guitarist putting his or her finger across the string of the guitar, the string will resist. And finally, there's a pluck. And of course, the piano, for every child who's tried on the family piano to depress the key as slowly as he can, you will finally get nothing, because a piano has what's called an escapement mechanism, or in the modern case, a double escapement. The harpsichord has none of that. We just play the string.
So do you recall the first thing that you learned to play on the harpsichord?
I really don't. I mean, probably some Scarlatti. And since I already had a fairly advanced piano technique, we did work from that. When I began taking the studies much more seriously, we started looking at French music, which is, I think, the most typical and idiomatic for this instrument. And this is certainly not to put anything over the music of Bach, which it becomes sacrilege when we imply that anything is more than that. But Bach himself predicated the style of his writing for the harpsichord on the French masters of his time and just before.
Well, it seems like the harpsichord, the final great expression of the harpsichord was in the French style.
Yes, yes. One of the first great expressions was within that, although it sort of blossomed throughout the continent and also in the British Isles. Early on, but I feel that one of the last outpourings is certainly in France just before the Revolution.
Mm. And with Bach, who you'll be performing a piece of his.
Yes.
And that also brings in the Italian tradition. So we were
absolutely
meshing Europe together quite nicely with Bach.
Bach is not the only German composer who liked the idea of bringing together various national styles, but of course Bach is really, really unique. So in one of his first published works, Bach had, again, composed a great deal before he actually decided that he wished to share that with a paying public, in other words, persons who could actually purchase a book. He first published a book of the six partitas for harpsichord, which I've just recorded. And then in his second published work, he gave us the so-called Italian concerto, which imitates the concerto grosso style, so orchestra, solo instruments of composers such as Corelli, even Handel, Marcello. And then the other big piece in that book is what we call the French Overture, which is basically a great big keyboard partita, largely in the French style.
Could I ask you to play some Bach
You could.
For us here? I don't know if you want to play what you will play tonight, or if that's what you're prepared to play. So I assume that's what you would play.
At this time in the morning, I'm not sure what my memory would be doing, so I think we might be safer with me actually playing what I'm going to do tonight. So I'd like to play for you on this very nice harpsichord, which we'll talk about in a little bit, but which I've just tuned, so listening audience, it may not be perfect right now at 11 in the morning. It will be tonight. This is the first movement of the Italian Concerto by Bach, and I'd like you to listen for what is the kind of bigger sound of the instrument. So I'm playing on the lower keyboard. And then when Bach wants to show us solo and accompagnato or accompanying instruments, I have the upper keyboard, which is noticeably softer. And I have a third stop on this instrument, which I simply couldn't get tuned for this morning. But when you hear me tonight, the difference between the forte and the piano, which are marked clearly in the score by Bach, are much more distinct.
So tonight we will pull out all the stops.
Mark, that would be precisely the case. Yes, we will indeed.
Fabulous. Well, I am here in Levitt Gallery with Troy Vinokur. Listening to a live broadcast from the Levitt Gallery on Tulane Public Media. I'm Mark Munger, joined by harpsichordist Jory Vinokur, and that was a piece of Bach's concerto. It's the Italian concerto.
The concerto, Italian concerto. You've got me going. Yeah. The first movement, which is without tempo marking.
Mm-hmm. I was going to dare to say it in the literal language.
I'm not sure that I can either.
I thought it was better not to, but that was lovely. And so this is the sound that really attracted you as a child.
Yes,
and
yes.
Can you describe what it is? Because it is an unusual sound.
Yeah, the harpsichord. You know, it's a great, great question. When we're discussing, first of all, Baroque music, which so often features polyphony, so moving voices against each other, the clarity of the plucked string instrument, I think, brings this to life better than, and forgive me for saying this, because I'm sure we'll have listeners who vehemently disagree, but I think it brings the point across better than any piano or pianist can. Mm-hmm. And I think this attracted me to the instrument. And although we have one instrument in front of us today here, the harpsichord also is so terribly and incredibly varied that whether I go from town to town, country to country, place to place, the instruments that I play can so greatly differ in quality, tonal richness. If I play an Italian type of instrument, which I would generally do mostly in an orchestra, that is another sound world than the type of instrument I'm playing today, which is more or less in the French school of instruments. So it's a different world, musically speaking.
And can we talk now about this particular?
Yes. So I can tell you a little bit about this. So this instrument was built nearly 30 years ago, 1989, by a wonderful fellow called Edward Kodak, who lives in Iowa City. And I've known Ed for quite a bit of time. And just one of these great, what do we call that, a polymath. I mean, somebody who is good at so many different things. So very active harpsichord builder for a number of decades with instruments all over the country. I don't remember the name of his book, so Ed, if you're listening to this, I am so sorry, but Ed wrote a book on harpsichord building quite a while ago, which is still kind of a Bible of the subject. It's just wonderfully researched and cataloged. And then this is a guy who otherwise you can find at the podium conducting Broadway shows for local theaters. So he's a wonderfully, wonderfully eclectic, knowledgeable fellow.
Mm-hmm. One thing that strikes me when I see a harpsichord is the design and the just opulent design of a lot of them.
Of course.
And the gilding.
Now, this instrument, public listening, I wish we could bring you here to see it. So this instrument, in some ways, quite discreet. So we're looking at an instrument with what I would call empire legs, so a beautiful harpsichord with a kind of a, would we call that like a dove egg gray color, or am I totally
That seems exactly
inventing?
Right.
Yeah,
no,
that seems I'll go for that. That sounds nice.
It
even
sounds
if
beautiful,
it's,
yeah.
Yeah. And so this lovely gray-colored instrument with gold outlining, the empire legs, which is to say fluted legs, Louis XVI legs, also have gold medallions at the top. And if we could bring you even closer to the instrument, you could look into the instrument and see that the soundboard has an unusually beautiful painting. That's absolutely successful. So during much of the Baroque, particularly in France and in the Flemish countries, harpsichords usually were painted on the soundboard. And it's a kind of a, I think, tempera paint. I don't think it's a heavy oil paint ever, even at the time. And this instrument features many, many of the hallmarks of the best type of that painting. So various flowers which decorate the, the open areas of the instrument between the various bridges. There is a beautiful little bird, I'm not sure what kind you are, hello bird, which sits right below what we call the rose of the instrument. The rose is, we could think of that like in a guitar, the open hole which allows the sound to circulate. Debatable on a harpsichord whether this actually serves an acoustic purpose. Some builders say yes, others say no. However, it was part and parcel of almost all Baroque harpsichord building. And sometimes the rose itself can be extremely ornate, bearing the maker's personal stamp, etc. Or in the case of Italian instruments, extremely complicated parchment layering, which can be astounding. This one on the more simple side, but the soundboard painting, exquisite. So everybody come tonight and have a look.
And I think, I have no idea if this is correct or not, but does that speak to the where one would generally have traditionally have heard a harpsichord? They would have been close to it. They would have seen the soundboard.
You know, it's a very, very good question. I mean, of course we see an instrument like this, and I think our fantasy brings us immediately to the various royal courts, which is not unfair, but other middle class or upper middle class households had such instruments. And an instrument such as we're seeing today could have been very, very possible in that type of household. I mean, a kind of a bourgeois or a upper middle class household. Sometimes in, let's say, the wealthier households or royal households, the instrument might feature a much, much more ornate decoration. One thing that was very popular in France during the 18th century principally is what they call chinoiserie, and for those who speak even a syllable of French, you can recognize China in that. So it is oriental type of designs which are done in gilding, and that was extremely popular in European furniture.
Okay.
In the 18th century, my own harpsichord has, I think, a rather good replica of of that, and is even more ornate than this one.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, speaking of the French household, one of the composers whose pieces you'll be playing,
Dufly. Jean-Philippe Rameau.
Oh, Rameau.
I
was going to say Dufly.
Jacques Dufly. We can speak about him too, but fascinating character.
Let's start with what you were going to say, because you must have had.
I thought you were going to just be speaking of Rameau, who himself is one of the great representatives of the Baroque epoch in France, so the High Baroque, around the same time as Bach. In fact, their dates coincide very nearly. And Rameau published five suites of harpsichord music, which is, in a way, not that much music compared to Bach, but far more than many other composers who would publish a book or two and then float by in their reputation. That was expensive. But Rameau ended up having a second career, we could call it like this, rather late in life, around the age of 50, his operatic works became much more celebrated. They were very, very complex compared to any other living composer, crazily difficult, but he developed a great reputation for that, and he concentrated his efforts towards theater works for the rest of his life.
And I see. Do you see a sympathetic character in him? Because as you love opera as well as
yes,
opera.
Yeah. I mean, do I see a sympathetic character?
Yeah,
in
I mean,
him?
Do you? I mean, do you the, sympathize with him? And
I think
him?
It's a fascinating yeah. character. And yeah. I've been fortunate enough not just to sit down and listen to some of the operatic works, but doing quite a bit of performing in orchestras with wonderful conductors. If we speak of Jean-Philippe Rameau. I've tried to think of what even our listeners here might know. For some of us, they would know very famous Gavotte and Variations. I'll just play a little bit of the theme. Do you mind?
No, please, please. Yeah.
And this is a Gavotte with variations. It was much beloved even by pianists a few generations ago. Now I think most of them would prefer to leave that to the harpsichordists. But the operatic works of Rameau are so rarely heard in America. In Europe, not only in France, but in Germany, England, people are a little more willing to take a chance. There's an outrageous comic opera called Platé, about an ugly little goddess of the swamp who thinks she's the hottest creature on the earth. I mean, she thinks she's the Beyoncé of her time and believes that Jupiter himself is in love with her. Uh-huh. And he's merely using her as a ruse to put off his jealous wife, Juno. So it's a very, very cruel and modern
that
comedy.
Terrible treatment.
And I was fortunate enough to play in an extremely famous production that the Paris Opera has done 5 different seasons and brought it to Santa Fe Opera here and elsewhere in Europe. So extraordinary. So to get to know this music and play it over and over, incredibly rich. And I am about to leave for Berkeley, California, and assist the conductor Nicholas McGeegan, who I think most listeners know, a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful conductor. And we are doing a never before heard in the States Rameau opera called Le Temple de la Gloire, the Temple of Glory, which features the only surviving opera libretto by Voltaire.
Oh, by Voltaire.
By Voltaire. So
they worked together.
Nick McGeagan, if he were here, would so articulately tell you the whole story. But they worked together. Both had difficult characters.
Yes.
The relation did not continue. Voltaire had other operatic projects in mind, even with other composers, but I think these never came to fruition, and he had many other things to do. The opera is awfully opaque. The story is very philosophical. There's not really, really a continuing story throughout. It's three differing tableaus, one which is vaguely historic, one which is vaguely mythological, the other I can't even think of how to describe, but the music is absolutely extraordinary, and the very complexity of the story rather adds to it.
Mm-hmm. So the music will carry you through. You just have to trust in the music.
The music is unbelievable. The music is simply unbelievable. And actually, the beauty of the French text is also remarkable. Mm-hmm. And this becomes, let's say, something also very modern, the kind of abstraction of doing an opera which is more on thoughts than just telling a story.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I would expect that of Voltaire, especially.
We would expect it of Voltaire, yes. And Rameau was also quite attracted to this type of modern theatrical endeavor.
Hmm. Well, could we hear some more Rameau?
We could hear some more Rameau. And if I were not worried about falling on my face in front of your listeners, I would have continued with that gavotte, but who knows. Why don't we hear two pieces from tonight's program. The first of these is called L'Entretien des Muses, which could be translated as The Gathering of the Muses. And this is an unusual, beautiful piece, but typical in that Rameau chose some of his favorite keyboard pieces from his harpsichord days, orchestrated these, and used them in operas later on. So this one appears under a different name in his ballet Les Fêtes d'Hébé. So this is L'Entretien des Muses.
Thank you.
It was Jory Vinicor performing live on Siouxland Public Media with a piece by Rameau. And I'll let you say it.
L'entretien des muses.
Yes, and yeah, you could hear the muses flitting, appearing, yes, disappearing as they devilishly do. It's gorgeous, a gorgeous piece.
It's extraordinary music. This is really composition of the greatest level. So I hope nobody would want to kick me in the ankles for saying it, but I really do believe that the great figures in Western music in the High Baroque are Bach and Rameau.
Those would be the two that you would choose.
These would be mine. Very different. There is not, these are the two inimitable giant figures for me.
Above Handel.
Oh yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Who I adore, and I'm performing.
You will be performing. Yes. Yes. There will be another Frenchman that maybe a lot of people won't have heard of.
Yes, who's called Jacques Dufilly, and without being able to give such a great deal of historical reference, this composer, Jacques Dufilly, of course, is beloved for those who study the harpsichord, one of the later composers for the instrument. And Dufilly never achieved great, great fame and never seemed to have really sought it, but he published, I believe, four distinct books of harpsichord music. And actually, there's rather a bit more music, if I'm not mistaken, than Rameau's own books. He was a teacher, very, very well known, but seemed to lead a very private life. And at a certain point, with the political uprisings in France, also with changing tastes in music, he seems to have disappeared to such a point that certain writers mentioned him, I think, in the 1770s, asking, does anybody know what's become of Jacques Dufilly, who was that beautiful harpsichord player who had the wonderful light touch? And Dufilly finally died alone and forgotten. I'm not even sure that he owned a harpsichord at his death. I think there is some mention of this in 1789, just as the revolution was really taking wing. And there's something so symbolic about this, the end of one epoch. If I'm to play a piece for us right now, it would be a fairly significant one. And we can hear how there are backwards-leaning references to the very ornate style of the Baroque, and something which sounds to us as though it were reaching forward, something more gallant, a little bit more Mozart-like in how the keyboard is used.
Okay, and that's something you would mind playing now?
I would like to play. So this is a Chaconne by Jacques Dufilly. Thank you.
Jory Vinicour, performing live in the Levitt Gallery on the campus of Morningside College here on Siouxland Public Media. That was Jacques Dufly's Chaconne. It's so colorful and yes. The changes of rhythm, just gripping. It was wonderful.
It's a very, very, very special work. When I remember very well, even to the date when I first heard it and by whom, of course, which was a live concert by one of my two principal teachers, Kenneth Gilbert, a very, very great Canadian-born harpsichordist, organist, who is still with us, but unfortunately very ill. And I hadn't yet met Kenneth, and I was to be his student from that day onwards, but we first heard him play in recital over in the Chateau de Clisson, not far from Nantes, and this was on his program, and I just was kind of bowled over.
And here you are today.
Here I am today, I guess, yes.
bowling us over.
Such
with the
a special piece. It's so evocative. Mm-hmm. And it is one of these things that can be evocative of something that we barely comprehend. I mean, mm-hmm. an epoch or to itself and the end of that epoch.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, those listening will have the chance to come here and be a part of this and hear this in this wonderful room. The recital is at 7:30 this evening.
Yes.
We have about a little under 10 minutes left.
Uh-huh.
And I did want to talk about Handel because
sure.
he's also on the program and it's hard to pass by. And it's a piece that's not, you know, the water music. It's not the music for royal fireworks. It's a piece that a lot of people probably don't hear often, because we don't hear a lot of other than the Messiah.
Funny thing, because, of course, speaking of the great composers of the Baroque, very naturally, we still today think of Handel. He's more fortunate in this country than Rameau in terms of opera performances. We think of the great big oratorios, Messiah particularly, although Handel himself considered Theodora to be his greatest oratorio work, and I might respectfully agree with him on that. Astounding. And yet the keyboard music is very, very rich. He didn't publish a great, great deal of it. He was a tremendous improviser, apparently. And there are elements even in the famous eight so-called great suites, which were published, I think, in 1720. Some pieces are a little more thrown together than others. Some are very highly composed, complex fugal movements, I don't know what. And I think, however, of the eight suites, the very most famous piece is the Air and Variations in E Major, which for reasons having nothing to do with Handel himself have come down to us as the Harmonious Blacksmith Variations.
Mm. Yes, there's an apocryphal story that he had taken shelter in a
And had heard the blacksmith. It seems to be absolutely apocryphal. And I don't know that Handel himself even heard the term applied to the piece. And it is utterly charming. There are some earlier versions of it. So the theme itself is really what I would call kind of a harmonic variation. And yet there's a real charm to it. And I think that might be the best way of closing out our morning.
Fabulous. I think that's a wonderful idea to close out the morning. Maybe we could go to that. And I'll mention again that the recital is this evening, right here where we're broadcasting from, in the Levitt Gallery on the campus of Morningside College. And for those that don't know, the Levitt Gallery is within Epley Auditorium on the main floor. And it's a wonderful, intimate room. You'll get to see
yes,
this.
Yes, it is an absolutely wonderful room.
This beautiful instrument. And of course, hear Jory playing, which is a true treat for all
Thank
of us
you, Mark.
Here. And we'll hear Handel's Air and Variations, known commonly as the Harmonious Blacksmith.
Thank you.
Again, Jory Vinokur performing here live in the Levitt Gallery on the campus of Morningside Campus. Handel's Air and Variations, known as the Harmonious Blacksmith, which he didn't know. That was how we would know it. And I didn't know he didn't know. I thought maybe he
apparently. I think the title came around after his time.
So even that image was never in his mind of a blacksmith.
I believe not.
Because it's so powerfully in my mind.
And the keyboard works as such were not necessarily that much discussed in his time.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of Bernstein and saying that, you know, trying to impose stories on music never works because the music continues and the stories end. But
that's true.
And there's a danger of trying to hold them in those stories. But
of course, and it's charming enough. Yeah. Bach's Goldberg Variations carry even more rather ridiculous stories than.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That do this, so.
Yes, putting somebody to sleep with the variations.
Which is even a misunderstanding of the myth.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't to put him to sleep, it was to amuse him and entertain him while he was awake.
Because he could not sleep.
Yes.
Yes. Well,
the famous Count Kaiserling.
Well, hopefully we've started some false stories of our own.
Exactly.
This afternoon.
Well,
we'll become famous,
Mark,
for that. Well, thank you very much, Joy, for coming in, and thank you for coming to Sioux City and performing this recital this evening. It's a gift to us all that you're here. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Mm-hmm. And this has been a live broadcast from the Levitt Gallery on the campus of Morningside College. My guest, Joy Vinokur, will perform a recital here this evening at 7:30. Thank you for your time again. I'm Mark Munger, and this is Siouxland Public Media, KWIT Sioux City 90.3 and KOJI Okoboji 90.7, broadcasting from the campus of Western Iowa Tech Community College.